The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan podcast by night, all day.
So you were saying you replaced Mike Baker?
Yeah, Mike's a great guy. He was a good officer. He was, he doesn't really talk about his work a lot. Maybe it's because a lot of years have passed, but he was the real deal. I replaced him in Athens, and he had done a lot of preliminary legwork in Athens. Athens was a tough place. At the time, the American government spent more money on security in Athens than they spent anywhere else in the world, including Beirut.
Why?
It was a combination of two things. There were two indigenous Greek groups that were exceedingly dangerous. One was called Revolutionary Organization 17 November. They had killed the CIA station chief, two U.S. defense attachés, just bad guys all around. The other was called Popular Revolutionary Struggle. And then on top of that, you had Abu Nidal, the Libyans, the PFLP, the PFLP-GC, the DFLP. Everybody was there because there was this informal agreement between the Greek government of Andreas Papandreou at the time and these terrorist groups that if you don't kill Greeks, we'll leave you alone.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. But killing Americans wasn't part of the deal, so it was every man for himself.
Wow. Your story is pretty nuts, man. And your story of getting in trouble and eventually going to prison.
Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the summary of your favorites podcasts.
Prison for something that was what they were doing, what you reported on, was completely illegal, and you were completely honest about it. And it was essentially about the U.S. torture program.
Right.
Tell us how this all started. Like, how long had you been involved in the CIA?
Oh, by then I had been in the CIA. Well, by the time I got to Pakistan as the head of counterterrorism operations after 9/11, I'd been in the CIA almost 13 years. And I was responsible for all counterterrorism operations in the country. Al-Qaeda was running out of Afghanistan into Pakistan because we were bombing the daylights out of them. And so my job was to find them and grab them and then just hold them or send them to trial was the original idea. And we were planning at the time for our first big name capture, right? Bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri. We had killed Mohammed Atef. He was the head of what they called military affairs for Al-Qaeda. We killed him at Tora Bora. But then there was Abu Zubaydah. And then there was this unknown person that we later learned was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. So we were looking for any of these four or five people. And then there were others, those responsible for the embassy bombings in Africa, the USS Cole bombing. So it just so happened that in February of 2002, we got a lead on Abu Zubaydah. And we captured him. It took us 6 weeks to track him down. And we were close a couple of times, close where we would bust down the door and there's like an uneaten, like half-eaten sandwich on the counter, a cigarette still burning. Sometimes we were a day or two behind him, but he knew we were looking and he knew we were close. So we finally got him. And then the question is, what do you want to do with him? And they told me, hang on to him. We're going to send out a plane and we'll take it from there.
As the conversation unfolds, a stark reality emerges. The brutal tactics used in interrogations may not yield the results intended. Explore how effective intelligence was finally extracted from a surprising source.
My mind, he said, there is no such thing as sleep deprivation. He said, I have a stand-up desk in my office. I don't even have a chair in my office. And sometimes I'll work 24 hours and then into the next day, 36 hours. But that's not what we're talking about here. We know from the American Psychological Association that people begin to lose their minds at day 7 with no sleep. And they begin to die. Their organs begin to shut down at day 9. But the CIA was authorized to keep people awake for 12 days. And that was another thing that caused prisoners to just die. They would have heart failure, you know?
How'd they keep them awake?
You chain them to that eye bolt in the ceiling again. You have these industrial strength lights on them 24 hours a day and like death metal 24 hours on volume 11. And they just can't sleep because if they collapse, they'll pull their arms out of their sockets. They're chained to that eye bolt.
Jeez.
It was bad. And then when people would die, They would just dig a hole next to the interrogation building, put him in the hole, cover it up, and then bring the next guy in.
No report, no nothing.
Nothing. There was one guy they reported on, and headquarters wrote back and said, just put him on ice until we can figure out what to do. And they literally just put him in a bathtub and filled it with ice, and then just decided a couple days later he started to turn. We should probably bury this guy. Yeah, it was ugly. And the Justice Department never said anything about that. They're like, oh, listen, you know, you can do these techniques, and if you kill him, just bury him out back. Nah, that wasn't the approved operation.
Was any of it effective? Like, was there any actionable information?
That's the worst part of this. No, none of it was effective. You know, I say this all the time, Joe. It's like a kick in my gut to have to compliment the FBI. But if there's one thing that the FBI is really good at, it's interrogations. They've been doing interrogations effectively since the Nuremberg trials in 45 and 46. These guys know what they're doing. And so with Abu Zubaydah as an example, we captured Abu Zubaydah, and normally overseas, the CIA has primacy. Domestically, the FBI has primacy. But 9/11 was still an open criminal investigation. And so we sent Abu Zubaydah out to the secret site and the FBI took over. The CIA was furious about this. But there was an FBI agent by the name of Ali Soufan who did exactly as he was trained to do. And he began to engage Abu Zubaydah in a conversation. And Abu Zubaydah just gave him the silent treatment for weeks. This went on for weeks. But you go in, you offer him a cup of coffee, you offer him an orange. If he's cooperative, you'll let him write a letter to his mother, you know, whatever. And finally, he opened up and he gave us actionable intelligence that saved American lives. And I'll give you two examples. Number one, we had no idea what the Al-Qaeda wiring diagram looked like. We knew it was bin Laden and Zawahiri, and then we just didn't know what the organization was like, how it was built. So he explained to us how each one of these cells all around the world was stovepiped, compartmentalized. Cell A had no idea what cell B was doing. And Ali said, as an example, if you want to do an operation in, let's say, Dusseldorf, how would you do that? And Abu Zubaydah said, well, there's this guy, Mohammed, and here's his phone number. Mohammed lives in Dusseldorf, and he has a cousin, Abdullah, and Abdullah has access to weapons, and here's Abdullah's email. And then Abdullah's got a friend, Rashid. They meet at the coffee shop, and Rashid has access to explosives. And then we're able to call the Germans and say, hey, listen, you have a serious problem in Dusseldorf, and here's what you need to do. And then they kick down the door, and they grab these guys. That saved lives. The other thing that he told us, and he laughed, actually, because Ali didn't know what the heck he was talking about. He was talking about Mukhtar. A guy using the nom de guerre Mukhtar. We knew from our own files that there was this guy out there who called himself Mukhtar, who was a very bad guy. In 1996, he had initiated something called the Bojinka operation. It was supposed to be carried out in the Philippines, and the idea was to hijack as many as 14 747s and then fly them into buildings all up and down the west coast of the United States. It just so happened that one day, Mukhtar, working on his plan, his diabolical terrorism plan, he went out to have lunch. And when he went out to have lunch, the cleaning lady came in to clean the apartment. And she sees all this stuff laid out. And she said, that looks like a terrorist attack being planned. She calls the cops. The cops come and say, ooh, this looks like a terrorist attack. We better call the Philippine Intelligence Service. They come and look at it and somebody says, we should probably call the CIA on this. And so we confiscated everything and Bojinka was disrupted.
That's well, crazy.
It's crazy.
A cleaning lady.
You never know. You just never know.
It's just crazy that he would leave the plans just laying around.
Thinking nobody's going to come. Nobody's going to see it. And then he ran off. So we knew there was this guy out there planning this big thing, and his name was Mukhtar. Abu Zubaydah laughed at us and said, you don't know who Mukhtar is? And Ali said, no. And Abu Zubaydah said, his name is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. That's the first time we ever heard that name.
Next, listeners will delve into a gripping firsthand account of government deception and the ramifications of exposing hidden truths, revealing the intricate web of power, betrayal, and the quest for justice.
So a reporter says, look, all these international human rights organizations are saying that the CIA is torturing its prisoners. What's your response to that? And the president looks right in the camera and he goes, "We do not torture," like that. And I said to my wife, who was a senior CIA officer, I said, "He is a bald-faced liar. He's looking the American people right in the eye, and he's lying to us." And she said, "Are you surprised?" Well, then on Wednesday, 2 days later, he gets a similar question, and he said that there is no torture. I knew he was lying. And then another 2 days later, it's Friday, and he's walking from the south portico of the White House to the helicopter to go to Camp David for the weekend. And a reporter shouts another question about torture. And this time he stops and he turns and he says, "Well, if there is torture, it's because of a rogue CIA officer." And I said to my wife, "Brian Ross's source is at the White House, and they're going to pin this on me." So I called Brian Ross and I said, "I'll give you your interview." And I decided in the whatever
why
it was.
Why did you think they were going to pin it on you? Because they were calling you the human rights guy, yeah. So that you were going to be a patsy.
Mm-hmm. And I was not willing. Yeah.
Because that's just your experience with the organization.
Oh, yeah. They're going to leave somebody out to dry to protect themselves. So I called Brian Ross. I said, "I'll give you your interview." And I decided that whatever he was going to ask me, and he never told me in advance what he was going to ask me, I was just going to tell the truth. And so he met me at the ABC News studios on DeSales Street in Washington. And I said three things in that interview that changed the course of the rest of my life. I said that the CIA was torturing its prisoners. I said that torture was official U.S. government policy. It was not the result of any rogue officer. And I said that the policy had been personally approved by the president himself. And then, as you can imagine, within 24 hours, the CIA files what's called a crimes report against me with the FBI, saying that I had revealed classified information. The FBI then investigates me from December of 07 to December of 08. And then they send my attorney a letter called a declination letter, declining to prosecute. They said that they had completed their investigation, that the information was already out there because of Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the Red Cross. But most importantly, torture is a crime, and it is illegal to classify a crime for the purpose of keeping it from the American people. So no charges. My wife and I went out to celebrate that night. We went to dinner. 3-4 weeks later, Barack Obama becomes president, and he names John Brennan, at first CIA director, but the liberals went crazy because Brennan was one of the fathers of the torture program. Everybody seems to forget that now, and we can get into that if you want, but he then names Brennan the deputy national security advisor for counterterrorism. Brennan immediately sends a memo to Eric Holder, the new attorney general, and says, talking about me, "Charge him with espionage." And Holder writes back, we got these memos in discovery when I went to trial. Holder writes back and says, "My people don't think he committed espionage." And then Brennan writes back and says, "Charge him anyway and make him defend himself." So they charged me with 5 felonies, 3 counts of espionage. They waited until I went bankrupt. And then they dropped the espionage charges. Yeah.
Oh, God, that's so gross.
That's Washington.
It's just so hard to believe that the United States of America government works like that. I believe it.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It's hard to swallow.
There's a book by Harvey Silverglate, who's a professor of law at Harvard University. The book is called 3 Felonies a Day. And he says that we are so overregulated, so overcriminalized in this country that the average American, on the average day, going about his or her normal daily business, commits 3 felonies every single day. So if they want to get you, they're going to get you.
In this gripping segment, listeners will uncover a suspenseful turn of events as the protagonist faces unexpected FBI scrutiny, igniting a harrowing battle for truth and survival that challenges everything he believed.
So I sat there, I wrote the whole thing, blow by blow. The next day he calls me and he says, 2 FBI agents are going to come up and talk to you. And I said, okay. So they come up, I recount the whole lunch, and they said, all right, here's what we want you to do. We want you to call him back invite him to lunch, and then try to get him to tell you exactly what information he wants and how much he's willing to pay for it. And I said, because I'm a patriot, I said, you want me to wear a wire? And they said, no, we're going to be at the next table. We're going to listen to everything. I said, but he only speaks Arabic. That's okay. We got a guy who speaks Arabic. Don't worry. I said, all right. So I call him. I invite him to lunch. We go to lunch, do the whole thing. But before the lunch, right before the lunch, they called and they said, operation came up. Just write us another memo. Do the lunch and write us another memo. I said, fine. So I write another memo. They asked me to do it a third time, a fourth time, and a fifth time. The fifth time, he says to me, I have great news. He said, I got my dream job. I've been promoted and I'm going to be the deputy ambassador in Cairo. And I said, congratulations. I shook his hand, never saw him again. So I've written all this to the FBI. One day in January of 2012, so I've been out of the Senate for about 9 months, the FBI calls. And I look at my cell phone, it says Federal Bureau of Investigation. I was like, I wonder what that's all about. So I answer, and they said, hey, you remember that thing you helped us out with a year ago? And I said, yeah. And they said, we've got a similar situation and we need your help. And again, because I'm a patriot, I said, anything for the FBI. I kick myself now for saying it. I said, anything for the FBI. What do you want me to do? They said, come down to the Washington field office Thursday morning at 10. I said, done. I go down there the next Thursday, and they're waiting for me at the entrance, which I thought was odd. And we go up to a conference room, and they said, we're both cleared, SI, TK, Gamma. And then there were two compartments above top secret that I was cleared for that they said they were cleared for. So if the conversation necessitated it, we could go into that area. So they said, well, before we start, just wanted to ask you, just read your book. It was great. I loved it. Hey, what about this that you said in your book? And I was like, yeah, okay. Yeah, it was a cool story. What about this other thing? Yeah, I had fun. I said, it was kind of hard. It took me 9 months to write the book, 22 months to get it cleared. Oh yeah, you got it cleared. Yeah, of course I got it cleared. 22 months it took me to get it cleared. And I'm thinking, what an odd question. Then they start asking me about something called the Sam Adams Project. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't know what that means. And then the bad cop of the two says, we know you've been giving information to the Guantanamo defense attorneys. I said, what are you talking about? And then I said, wait a minute, are you investigating me? And they said, yeah, and we're raiding your house right now as we speak. And I said, thank God. I said, I want to speak to my attorney right now. That was the only reason that they didn't arrest me. And one of the things that I learned, and this became painfully evident when they started arresting January 6th people, was the FBI in Washington likes to make its arrests on Thursdays because there are no federal arraignments on Friday. You're in the DC jail Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night, getting the shit beaten out of you. And then they arraign you on Monday. And then you want to make a deal just so you don't ever have to go inside that prison again. But because I asked to see my attorney, they let me go. So I called the attorney as soon as I got out of the office. Actually, when I was walking out, one of them went over to, I didn't know it at the time, but it was Peter Strzok. And Peter Strzok says, tell me he implicated himself. And the guy said, not really, no. We have to let him go. And so I grabbed my cell phone and I left, went to the attorney's office. They had already called my attorney and said they were charging me with espionage. I hadn't committed espionage. They knew I hadn't committed espionage. And in fact, since then, I'm fast forwarding a lot, three FBI agents have reached out to me. Well, two to my attorneys. One reached out to me directly to apologize, saying that this came from the top. They thought it was a BS case. They were sorry they were involved, but there was nothing they could do. One guy reached out to me through eBay, of all things, like to try to cover up the trail. He's like, listen, I've been losing sleep over this for the last 13 years. I just wanted to tell you how sorry I am, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, I hope you feel better. My whole life fell apart, but I'm glad you got that off your chest. So it became a matter of just survival after that. You know, you have to take it seriously. I was facing 45 years in prison. And then when the Justice Department made a request for a proffer meeting, the proffer meeting is they'll give you a little idea of what they have against you, and then they make an offer. You can take it or leave it. And they offered me 45 years. And I said, I'm not doing 45 minutes. I didn't do anything wrong. And this woman, she became deputy attorney general for the criminal division under Biden. She said, take this deal, Mr. Kiriakou, and you may live to meet your grandchildren.
Listeners are about to hear a raw and emotional recounting of betrayal, resilience, and the uphill battle for redemption as one man's story unfolds after facing unimaginable challenges and a fight for justice.
He said, buddy, I'm sorry. You're going to have to tough it out. And so that's what I did.
Wow. So you have this long career working for the government. They put you away. And what is it like for you to feel so betrayed and to get out? And what do you do when you get out?
I was frankly very angry when I got out. I didn't realize how angry I was. Like, people would mention it to me. Like, maybe you should talk to somebody. Maybe you should, you know, think about a pharmaceutical option. And I was like, why? There's nothing wrong with me. I'm ready to fight and march and, you know, raise my fist against the Obama administration. And so I was wrong, of course. I was so angry that it wasn't even healthy for the people around me. But I'll tell you, Joe, the hardest thing is you think you can just step back into your life again, and you'll never be able to step back into your life. So I thought, okay, well, I'm highly educated. I have a bachelor's degree in Middle Eastern studies. I have a master's degree in legislative policy analysis. I finished my PhD case classwork in international affairs. I got rejected by McDonald's, by Safeway, by Target, by Uber. We don't hire felons. I mean, I couldn't get a job anywhere.
And you're broke.
And I was broke. Bankrupt. Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't even get a job driving for Uber?
Uber turned me down.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. But you know what, though?
What did you do?
Well, I was confident that I was right and they were wrong. And my wife, unfortunately, she's now my ex-wife, but she gave me some of the best advice anybody ever gave me. She said, you have to keep telling your side of the story because eventually they're going to move on to their next victim. And if you keep talking, your side of the story is going to be the side of record. And eventually the truth is going to come out. And sure enough, 6 weeks before I was released from prison, I called her. I was allowed to call her every other day for 15 minutes. So I called her and I said, how was your day? And she said, it was great. And I said, really? Great? Why was it so great? And she said, because the Senate torture report was released today and it proved that everything you said was true. And I said, that is great. And she said, John McCain stood up on the floor of the Senate and said, if it weren't for John Kiriakou, the American people would never have had any idea what the CIA was doing in their name. And so when I got home, God bless him, one of the first calls I received was from John McCain's chief of staff. And he said, Senator McCain says, welcome home. And he wants to know what he can do to be helpful. And I said, oh my God. I said, tell him, I said, thank you. I liked McCain very much from when I was working on Kerry's staff. Kerry was a little jealous of McCain. And McCain would go out of his way to shake my hand and say hi. Kerry said to me one time, why don't you two get a room or something? And I said, no. I said, we have this connection over torture. I said, McCain takes me seriously and I take him seriously. And so when I spoke to McCain, I said, these damn Obama people, they confiscated my pension. And I'm going to have to work until the day I die. They drove me into bankruptcy and took my pension. Oh, he came up with this idea. It was a great idea to write an amendment. My attorney wrote this amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act of 2016. And it said that every American convicted of violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act between October 1st and October 31st, 2012, shall hereby have his pension reinstated. So, of course, I'm the only person in the world that refers to. So he said, nobody reads these 1,500-page bills. We're going to slip it in there. And he said, I'm going to be on the conference committee. We'll get it taken care of. And then he got sick. He got a brain tumor. And he wasn't named to the conference committee. And so they pulled it back out again. And then he died. And so here I am, 10 years later, the only way that this can be made right is with a presidential pardon. And that's what I've been working on for years now.
But
years.
What did you do for money?
I was offered a job at a small think tank in Washington called the Institute for Policy Studies. And they said, we'll give you an office, but you're going to have to raise your own salary. And so it was just like constant GoFundMes. I did that for a year. I made $20,000 for the year.
Unexpected twists unfold as the story deepens, revealing a web of intrigue and manipulation. Listeners brace themselves for astonishing encounters and startling revelations that will challenge their perceptions of loyalty and truth.
Why would he call a number in Pakistan when they don't speak Arabic in Pakistan? That just didn't make sense. So I saw him in the yard and I went up to him and he got kind of scared, like he was going to try to defend himself. And I had, you know, 6 inches and 100 pounds on this guy. So I said, wait a minute. I just want to ask you a question. Did the cops say anything to you about me? And he said, yeah. I said, what did they say to you? And he said, they told me that after we met, you called a number in Washington and they told you to kill me. And I said, oh, they did they? So I went back to the law library and I looked this up, and this was a Class D felony. It was conspiring to commit violence in a federal facility. It's punishable by up to 5 years in prison. So I wrote it in my letter and I sent it to my attorney, and I didn't give it a second thought. I didn't know my attorney was friends with Arianna Huffington, who then put it on Huffington Post with this banner headline. Millions of hits. The next thing I know, Jake Tapper drives to the prison to interview me. And it's in, I mean, it's everywhere from CNN to Playboy to The Economist and Time Magazine, when Time Magazine was a thing. And NPR's calling the prison to interview me. And the next thing I know, I'm called to the warden's office. Well, that's in an off-limits part of the facility. So the warden calls me in. He's like, I'm going to send you to solitary right now. And I thought, you know, is now the time to be humble before the warden, or should I stake my claim? And I said, warden, with all due respect, I've gone nose to nose with Al-Qaeda, with Hezbollah, with the Iranians, and you want me to be afraid of you? Give me some credit. He said, yeah. We'll see what you say when you've spent some time in solitary. I said, I've lived in Yemen, in Pakistan. I'm not afraid of your Loretto, Pennsylvania solitary. Besides, I said, go ahead and send me to solitary. CNN's going to be waiting for you next to your car in the parking lot. And I just looked at him. I never went to solitary, not for a minute.
Wow. Jeez. So they're just trying to set you guys up.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get you guys at each other's throat, and they, hopefully yeah, one of you will do something.
They did it one other time. One of my attorneys...
Do you know who orchestrated that?
No.
Do you that think it was could... the warden himself?
No. I don't think he was smart enough. I don't think he cared enough. It had to come from the agency.
Oh, my God.
There was one other incident, too. I lived in the same block of cells with an Afghan-American pharmacist who had an oxy problem. Nice guy. And he came up to me one day and he said, hey, the spokesman for the Taliban is here now and he wants to meet you. I said, the spokesman for the Taliban? I said, are you talking about that case in New Jersey? And he said, yeah. I said, I don't have anything to say to the spokesman of the Taliban. I don't want to meet him. And he said, oh, okay, I'll tell him. So I'm out in the yard one day and my attorney had warned me, they're upset at the shortness of your sentence. So be very careful. They're going to try to set you up and add years on. So I'm out in the yard, and here comes this guy with a beard down to his waist, and he's got his hand out to shake my hand. And I put my hands up so as not to touch him. And I look just past him, and there's a guard in the woods outside the thing with a long-distance camera lens, and he's going click, 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 click. And I said, don't you even think about touching me. And he said, oh, come on, man, come on. We have a lot in common. I said, we have nothing in common. I spent half my career trying to kill people like you. I said, get away from me. Don't touch me or you're going to end up unconscious on the ground. And he walked away and then he got transferred out. And I said, isn't it interesting that the spokesman for the Taliban was sent to our prison and was only here for 4 days? Isn't that interesting? And then they just gave up.
Wow. This kind of stuff is so hard to believe.
It's America. You don't want to believe this stuff.
You want to believe we're the good guys.
Yeah.
And you want to believe that we would never turn on our own like that over something that's just.
Yeah, but they do.
As the conversation deepens, anticipation builds around the implications of political maneuvering, highlighting the tension between systemic corruption and loyalty. Listeners will uncover the unsettling truth behind recent events and their significance in today's landscape.
Also, did they turn down the idea of bringing in the National Guard?
You know, I really don't understand. It appears yes. It appears that that's exactly what happened.
Also, significantly deterred people from committing these crimes.
That's right.
That they were encouraged to do.
I'll tell you, if I was at a demonstration and all of a sudden the National Guard showed up, I'd say, this isn't for me. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think most people would do that as well.
You're right.
It's crazy. It's just so gross that our legal system gets used against political opponents in that way, in such a devious and just a sinister way.
Harry Truman once famously said, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog.
Yeah. Yeah. God, what a gross business. It's just sad because I also am a patriot and I want to think of us as better than that.
Yeah, we're the good guys.
And I don't think it's necessarily the fault of these individuals. I think the system really sucks. And I think you work for that system, and just like all these Congress people that wind up insider trading, everybody else is doing it. It's the culture. You get wrapped up in it, just like bad cops. You know, you get assigned to a precinct that's filled with corrupt cops, and you have to do things to stay with them. They're your blood brothers, and you're all in this together. And so you wind up doing some criminal activities that you think are just, everybody does it, this is what we do.
Yep.
And you're an FBI agent. Well, we got to set this guy up. Okay, let's set him up. This is what we do. Hey, if he doesn't do it, he's not committing a crime. We got nothing on him. Okay. And
that's
then
right.
You just convince him to do it, and he's a fucking idiot. And so he does it, and he hits that cell phone, and now you're arresting him, and he's like, what?
Yeah.
And he's so dumb, he barely knows what happened.
And the chances are he can't afford a decent attorney,
right?
Or he's not notorious enough and newsworthy enough to get, you know, A-list attorneys volunteering pro bono. So he's stuck with a public defender that's going to spend 8 hours on the case, and he's going to get screwed in the end.
And there's also the narrative that's very difficult to shake. So if you get accused of some sort of a heinous crime, the narrative for most people that are casual viewers of that story is that you're a terrorist.
Yeah.
Or you're a guy who's going to kidnap the governor. Or you're a guy who is an insurrectionist who's trying to overthrow the government on January 6th. And then you watch the footage that they wouldn't release during the trials, and you see them getting a guided tour. The guided tour through like the security guards are walking them into the Senate. Like, what the fuck? What is this? Like, what is, and why is no one outraged? And why is it only one side that's outraged? God, if I was a Democrat congressman or a senator, or if I was any sort of a politician on the other side, I'd be like, do you know how disgusting this is? This is, you're using this to go after Donald Trump?
Of all things.
Instead of just better political opposition?
Exactly. And the media are to blame in part as well.
Well, they're bought and paid for.
Absolutely.
I mean, 100%. The media in this country is a complete and total failure. The only thing that's real media in this country are independent journalists.
That's right.
And there's mostly people who worked for large media corporations and either were fired or had to leave because of their own ethics and morals,
that's right,
and eventually branched out on their own, and now they're in grave danger.
Yeah.
You know, and they're worried about being prosecuted or set up.
I couldn't agree more.
Or killed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's super sketchy because we like to think of ourselves as better. This is the shining example for the rest of the world. This is the experiment in self-government that the whole world follows this lead. And when you see that, not just tolerated, but standard.
Yeah, it hurts. It really does. I was raised in a family like you were, where I was taught that this was the greatest country on earth.
I still think it is.
And I do too.
And
that's why we have to weed out the likes of John Brennan.
God. But it seems like there's a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
That are deeply rooted.
Dive into the shocking revelations that follow as controversial truths about government accountability and whistleblower protection unfold, leaving listeners questioning the very fabric of hope and change in politics.
Over there, and there was this entire wall of file folders. And she said, whatever you do, don't look in those folders. You're not cleared for that. Well, he said, well, of course, the very first minute that he's left alone, he runs and looks in the folders. And he said, every single one of those folders was on an American citizen. And the CIA is forbidden by law from spying on Americans.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
The crazy thing, too, in a lot of people's eyes is the difference between what they thought of, what the narrative is of the Obama administration in terms of, like, whistleblowers and, like, mm-hmm. what the hope was. You know, it was hope and change, right?
Oh, hope and change. And you know the statistic. The Espionage Act was written in 1917. To combat German saboteurs during the First World War. Between 1917 and 2009, three Americans were charged with espionage for speaking to the media. Under Barack Obama, eight people were charged with espionage for speaking to the media. So he was the enemy of whistleblowers.
Not only that, that was part of his campaign.
Yeah.
Part of his campaign
right.
was protection of whistleblowers.
Absolutely.
In fact, it was in the Hope and Change website.
Yeah. Well, look at the Dashti Lely massacre that I mentioned earlier. It was part of his campaign to open an investigation of Dashti Lely. What happened was at Dashti Lely, Afghanistan, on November the 30th and December the 1st, 2001, 2,000 Taliban soldiers gave up en masse. Right. And the Northern Alliance called us and said, what do we do with all these guys? We don't have room for them. So we told them, put them in trucks, take them out to the desert and just hold them there until we can divide them up and send them to smaller jails all around the country. And if we have to, we can send some to Pakistan. But there were no air holes in the containers. There was no food. There was no water. And of the 2,000, 14 survived. And one of the 14 said that when they opened the trucks in the desert, the bodies fell out like sardines from a can. So Barack Obama said in 2008, if he's elected president, he's going to investigate this massacre and get to the bottom of it. And then there was nothing. So I said to John Kerry, I said, listen, this is part of the Obama campaign. Let me go to Afghanistan and investigate this thing. And so I went, and there are still bones just sticking out of the sand. There are clothes that have just been laying there in the desert all these years. All the bodies are still there, what's left of them.
Really?
Yeah, it's grisly. So I come back and I get a call from a kind of a prominent human rights activist. And he said he wanted to see me, but it had to be private. So we went to Johns Hopkins University. There was a classroom that wasn't being used. We met there and he said, listen, I have a witness who was 12 years old at the time. And he was hiding behind a rock. And he saw what happened when they opened the trucks and the bodies fell out. I said, okay. And he said, but what's new is he says that there were two men there wearing blue jeans and black t-shirts and they were speaking English. I said, okay, that's all I need. So I wrote a letter to the agency and I asked, you know, for clarification, were any CIA personnel on site at the box up or at the location where the trucks were opened? And I had it auto-penned John Kerry, chairman. 6 weeks later, a colleague comes into my office and he says, hey, you got a response from the agency to your letter. I said, I didn't see any response from the agency. I just checked my mail an hour ago. And he said, they classified it top secret. It's down in the vault. I said, top secret? I said, well, what did it say? And he says, it says, go fuck yourself. I said, great. That's how they want to play it. So I went to Kerry and Kerry says, you know, we're stirring up a hornet's nest here, and I think we should just let this fade into history. I was like, again? Because you want so badly to be Secretary of State. Again.
God, what a gross business.
It's awful. Hideous.
What is it like for you on the outside now, watching what's going on in the world?
There are some places that I'm optimistic about. And actually, there are some developments that may look ugly on the surface that I'm optimistic about.
Next, explore the profound connections forged in challenging times. As our speaker reflects on friendship and the shifting dynamics of power in government, raising important questions about accountability and the truth in media.
I only wish that I had had the guts to do it myself.
Whoa.
And that made it, that changed my entire outlook on what I was facing. That I actually wasn't alone. And most of my CIA friends, like the people who were truly friends of mine at the CIA, are still friends of mine today. Right. They had to be discreet about it for a little while, but they never walked away from me.
Well, that's great. John, you're a strong man.
Yeah.
You know, I know how you've gone through all this, come out on the other side as a person who comments on the state of the intelligence agencies.
I'll add, too, that the election of Donald Trump, in kind of an odd way, freed me up to be more vocal because the Obama people and the Biden people were far, far more willing to say, that is speech that we don't like. That needs to be prosecuted. And with Donald Trump, and I don't know if he even meant to do this or not, it's like so much more is out there and in the public realm, the public domain.
Why do you think that is?
You know, I think at the end of the day, that's populism. It's just a different way of looking at government. It's funny because under populism, the feeling is very strong that they work for us and they answer to us. And with these mainstream administrations, whether it's Obama, Biden, George W. Bush, it's like, well, the wise men are running the government, so we need to sit by quietly and let them do their important work.
And that's how things like the Patriot Act get snuck in.
Exactly right. That's a great point. Yes.
And the NDAA.
And the NDAA.
Oh, we're not going to use that.
Right.
We won't use that on, don't worry.
You know, when I was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff, the Obama administration passed the NDAA in 20, whatever it was.
15.
Where they legalized propagandization of the American people. This came out of the most innocuous issue. We had this propaganda station, radio and television, called Radio TV Marti, and it was beamed at Cuba, right? The only thing the Cubans really care about watching from us is baseball. So we would broadcast a lot of baseball games. But the way it was being broadcast from Florida, there was this little strip of land on the Gulf Coast in southern Florida where they could pick it up, but only with like Dish Network, I think is what it was. Well, that's illegal because it's a propaganda station and Americans can't watch American propaganda. And so rather than like not broadcast it anymore or move the satellite or whatever, they decided we'll change the law to make it easier and legal to propagandize the American people. So now the government can produce any propaganda that it wants and foist it on the American people. It's like, thank you, Barack Obama. Now I don't even know if the news that I'm reading is real or not. Thank you.
That is so insane. That is so insane that that's the origin of it? Wow.
Yeah. Lazy bastard.
Well, lazy and also just taking advantage of an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is an opportunity to push something through that could be beneficial if you want to push propaganda on the American people. And up until now, it's been illegal.
That's right.
Has there ever been any talk of turning that back?
Oh, a lot of people believe that after Ed Snowden's revelations, it would be turned back, even if it were just, you know, one part at a time. And that's just never happened.
No. No.
Where's the outrage?
No, where is the outrage? And he's got to hide in Russia.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Crazy.
Depressing.
Do you think it could possibly push further in that direction?
Oh, I think that first of all, 100% yes. I think that it's natural that it would push further. It's up to us to push back. And I don't think the American people have their act together enough.
Well, we're too divided.
Yeah.
That's part of the
problem. We really are.
As the layers of political influence unfold, listeners will delve into the intricate dynamics between Israel and American politics, expect a gripping exploration of lobbying, power, and the unseen ties that bind them.
Are you worried about Israel's influence on American politics? Because that's one of the things that's coming to light over the last couple of years since the invasion, where people are paying more and more attention to Israel. And then also seeing what happens when you criticize Israel.
They are very quick to primary elected officials who criticize Israel, and usually they'll win those primaries. AIPAC is very well funded. It is very, very well organized. It's the gold standard of lobbying organizations. I've never understood why AIPAC doesn't have to register as a foreign agent with the Justice Department when everybody else does. Why is AIPAC special that it doesn't have to register? You know, back in 2008, I guess it was, I won a very small contract to write, it was like six op-eds for the Abu Dhabi Chamber of Commerce. And it was because I was going to write op-eds that supported American business in Abu Dhabi, right? So I had to go on FARA.gov, F-A-R-A.gov. It's the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And there's a form there. And I said, yeah, I took, you know, I won this contract. It was like 30 grand. To write these six op-eds, and the source of the income is the Abu Dhabi Chamber of Commerce, and here's my name and my address and my phone number. Enter. Done. I registered. So if you're doing something, anything, on behalf of a foreign government, you have to register, except if you're AIPAC. And I just don't understand that.
That seems so insane. And whenever you see, like, just dozens of senators and congresspeople going over to Israel, like,
Oh man, my very first week in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff, these lobbyists came in. It was a parade of lobbyists all the time. Every day they're coming in asking for something. So these two guys came in, could not have been any friendlier. Hi, welcome to the Capitol Hill. I said, oh, thanks. It's not my first go round. I've worked on Capitol Hill before. Well, we wanted to welcome you with an all expenses paid trip to the Holy Land. I said, thanks. No, I can pay for my own vacations, but I appreciate it. Oh, nonsense. We'll take you to all the Christian holy sites. Thank you. I've been. I don't want to go. And some of my colleagues went for their all expenses paid trip to the Holy Land.
Yeah.
Courtesy of AIPAC. I was like, yeah, no, thank you. Not interested.
Yeah, and that's just the beginning of it. That's nothing compared to helping out your campaigns.
Well, I'll tell you, I tell this story a lot, but I think it's appropriate here. I had been at the agency for 2.5 months, maybe. About 2.5 months. And I was told to give my very first liaison briefing. So this is going to be the Israeli Mossad and Shin Bet. And I was going to be one of about eight analysts, and I was the most junior, so I would go last. Well, we don't allow the Israelis into CIA headquarters. We used to, but every time they would come, they'd say, hey, we brought gifts. Here's a gift for you. And it's all packed full of listening devices and batteries.
Every one of them?
Every one of them. And we'd say, you guys, you can't come back here every single time and try to bug our conference rooms.
What'd they say to that?
Oh, sorry. We're not sure how that happened. So we're like, yeah, you can't come in here anymore. So we rent an office where we meet the Israelis off campus.
Wow.
Yeah, because you just can't trust them. So
that is so crazy.
We go to this briefing, and it's just two people. It's a woman who was the Mossad officer and an older guy who was the Shin Bet officer. Because we were all overt, we were giving our true names. And first, the senior political officer gives her briefing, and then the econ guy and the military guy and the oil guy, and finally it comes around to me. So I said, my name is John Kiriakou, and I'm going to brief you on Saddam Hussein's current psychology. And the Shin Bet guy goes like this. He goes, spell your name. So I spell it, and he writes it down. And he's looking at me over his glasses, and he goes, you are Jewish? And I said, I am not recruitable. Don't even think about trying to recruit me. Afterwards.
That's all for today. Visit podsummarizer.xyz and start creating summaries of your own podcast in just seconds. Don't miss it.